All right, welcome to Heino's Home Show. I'm Heino. This right here is my home show, where we talk about every week making the most out of your biggest investment, which is, of course, your home. As always, we are brought to you by the good folks at Accurate Mortgage Group. Whether you're looking to purchase a home or finance a home, they'll get you closed and back to life. Now listen, we got a jam-packed show for you this week. We'll talk about home theater design basics for that awesome man or woman cave. You know, don't want to discriminate there. And then we'll get into things that terrify a lot of people about refinancing their house. That's something that scares a lot of people. But first, let's talk about something that a lot of people are doing, either with their home or they would like to do with their home, and that's short-term rentals, like an Airbnb, for example, or VRBO. Joining me in the studio today is, of course, Steve Kenny, loan processor extraordinaire. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Heino.
All right. Later on, we're going to be visited by Vice President of Sales for Accurate Mortgage, Joe Stanford. But right now, it's just me and Steve. And Steve, we're going to talk about short-term rentals a little bit. Some people have thought about, and many investors have thought about and are doing, the short-term rental thing. That's kind of the rage right now.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, Nashville is always being kind of a hit place to be.
It is.
This segment, Airbnbs, VRBOs, you know, the short-term rental segment, has been very popular in Nashville kind of from the beginning because we're a destination city. A lot of people,
yeah, people
like
come here to vacation and stuff and check out the Country Music Hall of Fame and whatever.
Right. So Nashville, you know, recognizing that this was something that was going to affect their market, you know, Davidson County, which is the county Nashville's in, has actually regulated all of this since 2015. So this is not anything new, but it's kind of come into the news recently because they've had some regulation changes. Now, it's not all bad. Some people who live here, you know, are not all happy about Airbnbs. And so some of this is for the community, but there's actually a lot of good things that come with Airbnb or,
yeah,
you know, any short-term rental. I don't want to just pin that all on Airbnb.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't want to just pick on Airbnb, but because there's a lot of these sites now. There is Airbnb, there's VRBO, HomeAway, which is owned by Expedia. They're out there now. VacationRentals.com. TripAdvisor has one called FlipKey that they're
really
pushing right now. Priceline has one called Booking.com. And there's a couple of new ones called One Fine Stay, which is a little bit more for the upper-end luxury, you know, Airbnb type of thing. And then Nine Flats, which is another one that's just for apartment-type situations. But
that's pretty cool.
So I mean, one of the things that a lot of owners like about the short-term rental is that there's a lot less wear and tear on a property. I've known people who have nothing but short-term rental properties. They don't live in them. They just got a bunch of short-term rentals, and they actually make more money than if they rented it out 12 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And there's a lot less wear and tear because people are just there for short periods of time. They're not there long enough to like destroy the place, which happens a lot when you rent out places. But like you said earlier, some of the local governments have not been too happy with what's happened.
Well, yeah. So let's talk about some of the basics just, you know, to kind of understand what the process looks like.
Okay.
You know, the regulation, that sort of thing. So short-term rentals really fall into three different categories. So you've got your owner-occupied,
right,
which owner-occupied means you basically live there as your primary residence. But, you know, let's say that you're going to go on vacation for a week to Aruba. Well, while you're gone for that week, hey, why don't I rent my house out to somebody else?
Yeah.
So that's an example.
Make a little bit of money on your house.
Exactly. So you're not living there. They'll help with the mortgage payment. You know, it's somebody else's money, right? So that's one option. The second option, I should say, is non-owner occupied, which is like what you just mentioned. So this one's actually the most
controversial. So it's vacant most of the time.
Yes. Yeah, it is. The whole reason that this person owns the property is just to rent it out to people. So they don't live there, hence the term non-owner occupied.
Right.
Now, the third one that falls into a category is considered multifamily. So there's a couple of caveats in there, but multifamily is basically any multi-unit property. So if you've got
like a duplex, triplex, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. So there's a couple notable exceptions in there. So you cannot have a duplex in a residential area. If that area is zoned commercial and you just happen to have a duplex that's zoned commercial, that's okay. But anything like a 3 or 4 unit property that's in a residential area, those are acceptable for Airbnbs.
They are. Okay.
And the other one that was banned, that honestly I was really surprised, is tall and skinny. So, you know, that's kind of a thing here in Nashville.
Yeah, especially like the Green Hills area. They're popping up everywhere.
Yeah, so there's just a ban on those altogether. So if you have one of those tall and skinny properties, just can't do it.
You can't Airbnb your property.
Correct.
Or short-term rental, your property.
Right. Right.
Now, one of the things I've read is that owners are required to pay a hotel or motel tax when they short-term rent their property. Is that right?
They are. Yes, they are. They're required to pay that. And part of that was, due to the hotel industry, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's taking business away from them.
Exactly. So they just wanted to level the playing field. And of course, you know, the government will take their money however they can get it. So
I've noticed that.
Yeah, but there is, you know, there's not just a benefit of the taxes as well. There was actually a study done in 2017 that said the short-term rental market actually generates a value of about $477 million to a community.
And what does that mostly come from? It's just because the people are coming here, not only spending money at the Airbnb, but they're spending money at
local businesses,
local places, bars, restaurants, and whatever other attractions might be there.
Yeah, because some people, you know, when people are looking to go on vacation, if you've got a large family, getting a bunch of hotel rooms probably is not an option for you. It's just going to be too expensive. And if you've got young kids, you can't just leave them in a hotel room by themselves.
Legally, anyway.
Right. So having an option like an Airbnb or VRBO or whatever the case is, you can rent an entire house. And then that way everybody can be in that same area. And it's just like if you were at home, but you're on vacation.
Okay. So do you need to get a permit to do this, or can anybody just sign up with one of these websites and start renting?
Yes, you are required to get a permit. And actually, this is one of the regulation changes that we've seen recently has to do with the permitting process. So it was sometime in the fall of 2019, the Nashville Metro Council, which basically runs all of Davidson County, they voted and they set a hard stop date for non-owner occupied short-term rentals. So we were talking about earlier the three different types, right?
Right.
So that one is the most controversial, and it's the focus of some new legislation. So to put it into perspective, there's about 5,500 permits for Airbnbs or short-term rentals in Davidson County. Only 10% of those actually fall into this category of non-owner occupied.
Okay. Now, so most of them people, it's their home that they're renting out.
Right. It's either their home that they're renting out, or it's some of these, you know, purpose-built multifamily short-term rental properties.
Yeah.
So what they said is they set a hard date for no longer being able to acquire a non-owner occupied property, specifically for the purpose of doing short-term rentals.
Right.
So that date is actually January 1st, 2022. So we've got about 2 years left, you know, a little less than 2 years, where if you're looking at getting into this, now's the time to do it. So if you happen to get one in the next, you know, year and a half, 2 years, you're going to be grandfathered in so that you can continue to renew that permit, but you're not going to be able to get a new one.
So explain to me, why are they so dead set against a non-owner occupied short-term rental? You know, the place is going to be vacant most of the time, which is a quiet neighbor, you would think. So why are communities against that?
So this was one of the most common things that's thought of when it comes to Airbnb, not Airbnb, but short-term rentals.
Yeah.
So it has to do with quality of life for the people in the area.
Right.
So you're right. These homes are going to be vacant for most of the time. And especially during the days, if anybody is there, they're going to be out, you know, walking around, seeing the city, doing stuff.
People are probably renting them on the weekends, I would imagine, mostly.
Right. Yeah. I think that's probably true. I don't have any statistics to back that up, but, you know, they're all made up anyway.
So disappointed. Really? No statistics to back it up.
So where the issues come in is really at night. So when people are renting these Airbnb properties, and we're talking mostly about single family homes when we're talking about these non-owner occupied.
Right, right.
A lot of people who are renting these are big families, or maybe it's a big group of friends, and they're coming from all different parts of the country, and they haven't seen each other in a while. So when they get back from doing whatever they're doing out on the town, they want to keep the party going.
Yeah, okay, so, I can see that.
Right. So that leads to like sound violations, and the neighbors, have people outside at all hours of the night. They're having issues with parking. They're seeing lots of trash because, you know, people are out buying stuff. They're bringing dinner home, doing that sort of thing. And then when they leave,
they just dump it
outside.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of complaints from, people living in areas that are affected. And the other biggest part that also comes up with this, which is really more something for the county that they've been watching, has to do with affordable housing.
I was going to ask you about that, because you would imagine that now there's less or fewer, I should say, places to rent.
Yes.
Because people are purposing them for short-term rentals. So now the inventory for rental space has gone down.
Yeah. So we talk a lot about, you know, the lower end of the market, because that's where most people are buying houses. And when I say lower end, I really mean like 200, 300, 400,000. Mm-hmm. So in those price ranges, a lot of investors are coming in and they're paying cash because they can get huge returns. And so what's happening is you've got somebody who's a local buyer who wants to live here.
Yeah.
You know, they're putting in a contract and maybe they're putting down 5% or 10% and they're getting a mortgage for the rest. Well, you've got these big hedge funds, mutual funds. People are coming in and buying single family homes.
Yeah.
And they're paying cash. So if I'm selling my house and I'm looking at a full price offer at, you know, 10-day close, all cash, absolutely, I'm going to take that over, you know, something with a contingency for financing. So it's creating a lot of competition. And so that's part of the reason that they want to put this hard stop on non-owner occupied, because that allows people to have access to more affordable housing. So there's not as much competition.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Let me ask you this. Why is it a problem for the tall and skinnies? Why did they single those out in particular in some neighborhoods?
That is related to, I'm going to get a little technical on you, so bear with me.
Uh-oh.
You've heard of the term HPR, horizontal property regime.
Yes.
It's basically where a builder buys a property and then they put two houses on that
right.
one
piece really
of
property. Skinny, tall ones.
Right.
In exactly. the spot where one house used to be.
Right. So the issue is because of the way they're regulated and the way that they're set up with the county, you've got two houses and it's considered a single family house, but they're still managed by an HOA. Mm. Usually there's no HOA dues, but there's still an HOA agreement. And so violating that agreement is where the issue comes in, because the person who owns, let's say, unit B is not going to rent theirs. They're going to live there. And then the person who owns unit A, they are going to Airbnb it or short-term rental. And so it's a violation of that HOA agreement.
Gotcha. Well, we've just touched on the tip of the iceberg with short-term rentals. It's a hot thing. If you're interested in doing it, definitely do your research before you go buying anything, because there's a lot of new regulations that affect that decision. We're going to come back here in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about setting up your man cave or woman cave as a home theater. So we'll be right back here on Hino's Home Show. All right, welcome back to Hino's Home Show. I'm here with Steve Kenny.
Hey, Hino.
My partner in crime here. So let's talk a little bit about home theater design basics. Most people, you know, you've decided, let's say, to add a home theater to your house. You know, you want to set up that man or woman cave, and you're ready for that home theater setup so you can, you know, have that great movie-going experience right there at your own house without the sticky floors of going to, you know, a regular movie theater. The only problem, of course, is where in the heck do you start? I mean, the choices are dizzying. I mean, I was looking on Amazon. There's over 700 listings for different kinds of home theater speakers alone.
Wow.
So you'll spend a lot of time reading those reviews. So you know, it'll take you a long time. So where do you start?
You know, I think the first place to start would be to find the space to put one.
You're right. Right. Like, where would you put yours?
I'd probably put mine in the basement.
Okay. Yeah. If I had a basement, I'd probably put one in there too, because one of the things that experts agree is that the shape of the room is really important. I never really thought about that before. They say stay away from square rooms. You don't want to have a perfectly square room, mainly because of the way sound bounces around. It can create a harmonic distortion in the sound that you're hearing from your movie, and that kind of just messes things up. So they recommend at least a rectangular room, longer okay. than it is wide, and to put the screen at one of the short walls, put it at one of the ends, so that you can kind of mimic the shape of a movie theater
okay.
with where you're going to put your seats.
Well, that makes sense. I guess if movie theaters are running a business, they've probably done a lot of this research.
They've
for
you, probably
right?
figured it out. Yeah. You don't probably go into any movie theater and notice that it's square. I'm guessing no. there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the other things that they say is the fewer windows, the better. So if you've got a basement that with no windows, you're golden. You're set up. You're ready to go.
Now, what's the reason for having no windows?
The glass is very reflective, and the same problem. You're going to have sound bouncing off of those windows.
Okay.
Plus, of course, the ambient light that you get from those windows kind of distracts from the brightness of the screen. So if you're trying to okay. get, you know, there's a reason that movie theaters are dark.
Yeah.
Because all the attention is focused on the light of the screen and not the other light in the room. So, of course, you can fix that with heavy drapes or blinds and that kind of thing. So if you don't mind, you know, walking over and closing them up before you watch, you know, the latest you know, shoot 'em up opus, you know, or superhero movie that's come out this week.
Old country western.
Old country westerns, that kind of thing. But yeah, so that's one of the reasons you don't want to have windows.
Okay. So I've heard that you're probably not supposed to have like hard wall surfaces either. Is that true?
That's true. Like brick, for example. Mm-mm. No, that's a no-no. No brick, even if it's painted, just because it's very reflective. And so sound is going to be bouncing everywhere in that room, especially if you turn it up. And over time, as you're sitting there watching a movie, it's going to get really distracting and really annoying. So one of the things that they recommend, of course, is to break up the wall space. So you can do that with acoustic panels like we do here in the studio. There's panels up to absorb sound and not have it be bouncing around so much. And those are actually fairly inexpensive to get. You can get them online, and they can look like paintings. They can look like all kinds of things so that it doesn't look like a sterile environment.
Well, and you can probably make them yourself, too, if you're handy.
If you're handy, I'm sure if you've got, the wherewithal, actually, you can probably find it on YouTube. Everything's on YouTube. You want to know anything, how do I make my own movie studio or movie watching room sound panels? I'm sure you'll find it.
You know, it's funny you mentioned YouTube. So I personally use YouTube a lot for trying to figure out how to do stuff.
Sure.
So if you Google, obviously Google and YouTube, Google owns YouTube, I guess.
Right.
So if you use Google and search for something, Google will now actually indicate where in that video it starts talking about certain topics.
Really?
Yes.
That's
so if you've
neat.
Got, you know, because this was one of my complaints, you know, a year or so ago until Google started doing this, is you may search how to, you know, wash my windows, and now you've got a 12-minute video about washing windows. You could probably condense that down to like a minute and a half.
True.
But if you've got a 12-minute video, they're going to indicate, okay, at 3 minutes and 42 seconds, this is where they start talking about the supplies that you need. And then at 4 minutes and 30 seconds, they start talking about how to prepare the supplies. So it really kind of breaks it down. So that's a cool feature. I don't know if you've ever seen that before.
I have not noticed that, but now I'm going to be looking for it. I'm probably going to see it everywhere when I go home tonight and research how to build these sound panels for my future man cave that I'm sure going to have at some point in my life. I've got a bunch of kids and, you know, family and everything. So I don't really have a man cave. The house, the garage, I guess, could be considered my man cave if I squeeze in between the lawnmower and all the kids' bikes and balls and toys and all that sort of thing. It's more of a man corner, actually, than it is a cave. You know?
It's
like, go to your corner.
Right. So what about, like, other design features? Like you had mentioned, you can do these sound panels and, you know, make them look cool so that when you're not using the room as a theater, if it's part of your family room or whatever.
Well, one of the other things that they recommend is to stay away from bright colors. So when you're painting your surfaces, your walls and things, go with natural browns and tans and earth tones, that kind of thing, because stronger colors like bright reds and blues, for example, they'll give an odd cast to the ambient light that may affect the colors that you see on the screen.
Really?
Because, you know, light is all reflective. And so if you've got bright yellow walls, then that kind of makes everything in the room look yellowish if there's a bright sun coming in or if there's a lot of lights on. So it's just something to consider because you don't want to distract from the movie that you're watching or whatever it is that you're watching. Yellow walls might be fine for another room in the house. But if you're trying to set up a home theater where the main goal is to watch awesome things on this ginormous screen that you got down at the end of the room, you want to stay away from bright colors.
You know, it's funny you say that because I thought the reason you stay away from bright colors is because it's just going to take your focus off of the screen.
Well,
not actually change the image, which, I mean, that blew my mind. I had no idea about that.
Yeah.
But I would think if you had bright yellow walls, I'd just be looking at the walls the whole time instead of looking at the screen.
You're easily entertained, aren't you, Steve?
I am.
It's like, wow, look at the walls. Forget the movie. Well, of course, speaking of looking at things, I mean, one of the most important features in any home theater is, of course, the TV.
Yeah.
What do you? Again, there's a million choices for that. But I've kind of found, I did a little bit of research before we did this segment today, and I kind of found the kind of like the creme de la creme, the high end, and a really good kind of budget end for what makes a good TV for your home theater. So Sony makes what they call the Master Series TV. It's this beautiful 4K TV. It's got a gorgeous picture. I went out and looked at it over the last weekend, and it's beautiful, but it's not cheap. It's like between $2,000 and $3,000 for this 65-inch TV.
Ooh.
But if you can afford it and you want to get the best, you know, you want to go that way. That's the way to go. But on the other end, there's a company that a lot of people maybe don't know about. It's called TCL. They've been around for a while. They've kind of had a reputation in the past of building like the really low-end, junky kind of stuff, but they've really turned their stuff around in the last few years, and they're building really good things now. And they have a series of TVs called the 6 series, and you get a lot of the same features and a really great picture for about, I don't know, $700, $700-$800. So wow, that's kind of like the lower end. If you can afford it, you get a nice big TV that way as well for your home theater. But of course, you're going to have to marry that home theater TV with some home theater sound.
Yes.
A lot of people don't realize is that movie soundtracks a lot of times are broken up into separate channels, like 5.1, for example, which means that there's sound spread over 5 different speakers. You, of course, got, you know, like a normal stereo sound. You've got your left and the right that you would have on either side of your TV. But then there's that center channel. That's the third channel. And that's where all your main dialogue and all that stuff. So that's like probably the most important speaker out of the bunch, because that's where the intelligibility comes. You know, you've all heard movies played on a sound system that's not, maybe not that great, and you can't understand what people are saying, especially if there's a lot of explosions and, you know, all kinds of stuff going on. So that center speaker's got to be really good. And then, of course, there's the two in the back.
Okay.
Which kind of...
That just gives you the immersive experience.
Exactly. If there's a train going across the screen, you hear that train going from left to right behind you, that kind of thing. And then, of course, the subwoofer, which will give you the nice bassy rumbling sounds especially important on action movies, that kind of thing. So those are very important. You want to make sure that center speaker is very, very good. So,
It's funny. A lot of people... I shouldn't say a lot of people. I would say there is a portion of people out there who always have to get the latest and greatest thing.
That's true. You know,
I'm not one of those people personally.
No.
So
I like to read about it, but I don't actually go out and get it.
Yes. Agreed.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the reason that we do that is because I feel like, you know, a new TV like this Sony TV that you were talking about right now, it's $2,000 or $3,000. If I wait maybe a year or two, you know, it may only be $700 or $800.
That's true.
So,
I mean, if you look back a few years, flat screen TVs were enormously expensive when they first came out. They were like $15,000 for like a pretty small one.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm in our house, we're always like one generation behind. So like right now there's, like OLED TVs, I think, are the big thing.
Yeah. Right? OLED. Right.
Yeah. OLED. So we don't have an OLED. We just have a regular LED TV, but it's still 4K. And you know how much we paid for it? $500.
See, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I think I paid around the same for mine as well. So, and it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It works great.
I mean, yeah. Do you notice the difference if you look at them side by side? Sure. But you're not, when you have the thing at home and you're watching it, you know, you don't have the fancy one right next to it. It's going, oh, I wish I had that one.
You know, so we were talking to someone in the office the other day about the quality of TVs,
right?
You know, kind of on the same topic. And so they brought up a really good point. A lot of broadcast TV is only done in 1080p.
That's right. That's right. So a lot of these 4K TVs that you're buying, you're not really seeing 4K pictures because the broadcast networks don't broadcast in 4K for the most part.
Right.
And when cable providers or satellite providers, they down convert the signal to be able to broadcast it more quickly. And so by the time it gets to your TV, it's not 4K anyway.
Right.
So why spend, you know, now they've got 8K TVs.
Like, do they really?
Oh yeah. It's like, why spend the money? Because unless you're watching programming that's like on a disc or something,
okay,
where you're getting it directly from the source, if you're watching it over the air, you're not getting that 4K. So anyway, I hope this helped you a little bit on figuring out how to set up your home theater. We're going to be back with a whole lot more in just a minute with Heino's Home Show. Welcome back to Heino's Home Show. We are glad that you joined us again and that you stuck around. Of course, we got Steve Kenny here in the studio with us, mortgage processor extraordinaire. And we also are now joined by our special guest, Joe Stanford, who's the vice president of Accurate Mortgage. So he knows a lot of stuff about mortgages and that kind of thing. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Heino.
All right. Well, glad you're here. So we kind of wanted to talk in this segment a little bit about refinancing. That's something that scares some people, and there's certain aspects of about it that kind of scare people. So I kind of want to clear a few things up. And one thing that I noticed right now, just from looking at the trades, is that refinancing in the U.S. is like up. It's like at an all-time high, or at least for the last 6 years, it's at a six-year high. More people are refinancing right now than ever before.
Wow.
Why do you think that is, Joe?
Yeah, I know you can certainly attest to this, but it's crazy right now with the amount of refinance volume we have going on. I think we've had a record week just in the amount of applications and inquiries that we have, but primarily the interest rates are driving that.
Aha, the ever popular interest rate. Everybody wants a lower interest rate, which is a good thing, right? I mean, they haven't been this low in a while.
Certainly a good thing. I mean, they're definitely at a low of about the past 3.5 to 4 years. I mean, we're seeing people that purchased a house in the last 12 months where they're able to refinance and significantly drop their mortgage payment. And so we're just a small little subset of the population here in Nashville. So all over the entire country, you're seeing it at a 6-year high right now.
Wow, that's pretty good. I think I read that like 65% of all mortgage applications, Steve, are refinances right now. Wow. It's like outpacing purchases, which is kind of amazing.
You know, that doesn't really surprise me a whole lot, only because, like we've been talking about, the rates are so low. I mean, me personally, and Joe just kind of mentioned this, people have bought homes in the last 12 months. We personally are refinancing right now. So
you that, are.
We are.
I didn't get that phone call, Steve. I'm a little disturbed by that.
That's all right.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think a lot of people, and I get this question all the time, people are worried that their credit score is going to take a hit if they're inquiring about a mortgage and they, you know, of course a credit inquiry is part of the process. You got to do it to make sure you qualify and everything. And one of the things that scares a lot of people is, oh, it's going to ruin my credit if you do that. And that's a kind of a common misperception. That doesn't really happen as badly as people think it does.
No, it doesn't. You're right. I mean, in years past, when I say years past, over 10 years ago, that did hold true. But several years ago, some legislation was passed where shoppers now have the opportunity to go out there and shop for a mortgage loan. Mm-hmm. And they have a period of 30 days where they can have their credit pulled, and it will not affect their credit score.
So my understanding is the first one does a little bit, just a tiny little bit.
The very initial pull, they're going to see a very small drop, 2, maybe 3, 4 points, and then after that, you know, they're able to have multiple pulls without affecting their credit.
As long as it's for a mortgage.
For a mortgage, yeah. You go out there and start shopping for credit cards and cars and boat all at once, then you're going to see your score plummet for sure.
Yeah, you've probably got other problems if you're doing that anyway. But yeah, that's actually an important distinction. I mean, if you apply for a credit card or an auto loan, that will affect your credit a lot more than a mortgage-related inquiry would.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it typically declines for about 3 to 6 months on a regular credit pull, but on a mortgage-related one, I think it's only there for about 45 days, and then it kind of bounces back.
Yeah, it's only going to be there for about 45 days because they're simply looking to see what happened. The credit bureau is waiting to see, okay, you got a mortgage inquiry. Did you buy a new house? Did you refinance? What exactly did you see? Mm-hmm. What exactly happened? And 45 days is generally enough time to pass for them to know.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. Well, there's a lot of reasons that people are refinancing right now. I mean, obviously, the lower rate is something that everybody wants. And you know, going along with that is the lower payment. You get a lower rate, hopefully your payment goes down. And actually, depending on how long it's been since you've financed in the first place, your balance is going to be a lot lower. So your new mortgage payment is going to be based on not only the lower rate, but also a lower balance. So it can really lower your payment a lot if you're lucky. But one of the things that I'm seeing the most, and I don't know about you, Joe, but people are consolidating debt. A lot of people have credit card debt, all kinds of really high interest. My eyes water sometimes when I see what kind of debts people have. What are you seeing?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the interest rates are at an all-time low, which certainly helps, but I think bigger picture is what you just said. It's really kind of a perfect storm where values have appreciated year over year for the past 5 years. On top of that, rates are at an all-time low. And so what we're seeing the most of is what you just said, Hino. It's the debt consolidation, cash out refinances, where not only are you dropping your current interest rate, but you're also able to wipe out all of your credit card debt. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe versus credit card debt, maybe you're needing to remodel the house, you know, yeah. But you're able to do all those things and still lower your overall payment.
Now, what would you say to somebody who says, oh, I don't want to consolidate that one because that's a zero interest rate credit card. I still got another 9 months of no interest payments on that particular card or auto loan. My auto loan's only at like, you know, 1% or something crazy like that. So I don't want to roll that one in. What would you say to that person?
Yeah, great question. So on the two different questions, I guess, from a credit card standpoint, my answer would be, well, what are you going to do in 9 months? Do you have 20 grand? Do you have 30 grand? If you do, hey, absolutely, you're right. You know, there's no reason to refinance that. If you don't, then you need to do something, because a mortgage rate of 3.5% or 4% is a whole lot better when that credit card turns to 17% or 24% interest. And the car is kind of another story. I mean, I would say if you do have a car loan that's at a very low interest rate and you don't have to refinance that, you don't have to consolidate that, you'd probably be right to leave that out. But any other type of unsecured debt, be it credit card or mortgage related debt, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world to refinance that.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Now, as far as other reasons to refinance, obviously we got consolidating debt, but what about renovations? I mean, that's something that people pull money out. They do, you know, they add on to the house, they put in a new bathroom, they do things to increase the value of the house. So not only are they getting money out to do that, but they're hopefully making their house worth more.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things we're seeing right now is because of the lack of inventory, you're seeing a lot of people enter the market, they start to shop for a home, and it's not out there. You know, that perfect home doesn't exist for a number of different reasons. And so they end up saying, hey, what can we do to the home that we're in now to make it our dream home? Mm. And so we're seeing a lot of that because property values have gone up significantly. People are able to refinance, take cash out, and redo that kitchen. They're able to put the deck on the back. They're able to add the extra bedroom, and all while staying in that existing home and adding value and creating wealth by doing so.
Okay. Well, what do you think about, I don't know how I feel about this, what do you think about people taking cash out of their house to go and do investing? Maybe the stock market or buy another property or something. What do you think about that strategy? Is that something that's wise to do?
Yeah, I mean, I would always counsel you to go back to your financial planner because everybody's going to fall into a different spot there. However, can it make sense? Absolutely, it can. I mean, look at what the market returns over time, and then compare that to what the interest rates are. If you're going to get a rate of 3%, 3.5%, 3.25%, what rate is the market going to give return on average? And, you know, do that math, and if one's greater than the other, then that's absolutely going
to
make sense.
So if you can find a way to get, let's say, get 10% return on your money outside of your house, then that beats the 3 or 4% that you're paying on your mortgage.
Absolutely. I mean, easy math. You're going to pick up 7% or 6% there, and I'll take that all day long.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that we didn't really touch on when we were talking about consolidating debt is that, at least for now, mortgage interest, I should say, is tax deductible, or at least a lot of it is, whereas your interest on your credit cards and that kind of thing, or even second mortgages, it's not tax deductible right now.
Yeah, that's a huge part. Like you said, the monthly savings are one thing, but on top of that, you're going to have the annual savings when you go to do those tax returns, because you're going to be able to write off all the interest that you're already paying it anyways. You're paying it on those credit cards, whether you want to or not. And so by doing a debt consolidation loan, wrapping it into your mortgage, you're now able to also write off the interest. So you're going to save money by dropping the interest rate. Then you're also going to save money come tax time.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I know you've seen this before. We've both talked to people that like are interested in refinancing. And they've got some debts to pay off, but they just want to wait. They want to wait for whatever reason. Most of the time, they're hoping that the rates next week will be better, or a month from now will be even better than they are now. Now, they have been trending lower lately, and there's some speculation that the Fed might cut rates a little bit more, but is that a wise move? Is that a smart thing to do, to wait?
Typically, I'm going to say no.
Why?
The reason is because, and this is kind of an old adage in the mortgage industry, that trying to time rates is like catching a falling knife.
Okay.
So you might catch the handle, but you might also catch the blade if you try and wait. So if rates are low and if it makes sense to do it now, it probably is going to make sense to do it tomorrow, and there's not going to be a huge difference.
Okay.
So you really have to consider, you know, how high are my interest rates on my credit cards? If I'm paying 16%, even if I'm at, you know, 3.5%, 4%, 5%, whatever it is, that's still significantly less than paying 15%.
Right, right. And what I think one of the things that causes people to want to wait is these rumors that the Fed is going to reduce their rates again. But Fed does not control mortgage rates, right?
Right, right. So we actually talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The Fed lowering the interest rates is actually based on the overnight discount rate. So it's banks borrowing from banks for one day. Mortgages are going to be over 15, 20, 25, 30 years.
Okay.
So though there is some correlation, it's not exact. So if rates go down, if the Fed lowers rates, mortgage rates could still go up. And we've seen that happen, you know, about 50-60%
of the time. Which is totally counterintuitive, what most people would imagine.
It is.
Yeah. Hey, they lowered the rates. Why are we now at like 11%? Which we're not. But, you know, they were there at one point.
Yes.
I saw an ad, an old ad from a big mortgage company I saw on the internet the other day, and it was like, rock bottom rates at 11.5%. And it just kind of made me chuckle. It's like, people forget that they used to be way, way, way up there. So basically, it's always a good time to refinance, I guess, is what you're saying, as far as the market goes, because you just really don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, it's always good to look at it and talk to a professional. You know, someone's going to walk you through the numbers and show you the math of here's how much interest you're paying now, here's how much interest you would pay in a new mortgage. And you guys can have that conversation to decide if it's going to be good for you.
All right. We are going to come back with a whole lot more of Hino's Home Show here in just a minute. We got Joe Stanford, Steve Kenny. Stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to Hino's Home Show. Thanks for coming back with us. This segment, we're going to talk about something that you probably don't think about too often, the cost of waiting. I mean, if you're shopping for a home today, you know it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And sometimes people, they don't find the right house right away, and they get a little kind of tired of the whole process, and they get discouraged, and they say, you know what, let's just take a few months off and come back at this in a few months, and we'll try again later. So joining us here is Joe Stanford, Vice President of Accurate Mortgage. Joe, is that a good idea to do that?
Yeah, you know, Hino, I know that you've seen that a lot here lately, as of I, where we're getting people that are, we spoke to 2 and 3 years ago, wanted to purchase a house. They decided that they were going to wait. Now they're re-entering the marketplace only to find, hey, guess what? Prices are now even higher than they were 3 years ago. It's even harder to buy a house than it was 3 years ago. So I guess the short answer would be no, it's not a good idea to wait. For a number of different reasons, one, the interest rates are at an all-time low. That's going to drive your total cost of the home. And then the bigger picture is there's not about to be another flood of houses come on the market. So there's a housing shortage today. A year from now, there's still going to be a housing shortage. So that housing shortage is going to continue to drive prices up higher and higher and higher. So the longer you wait, the more money you're going to spend to buy that same exact house.
Yeah, and that goes for if you're trying to sell a house as well. I mean, because you might think, oh, I'm going to wait so that I can get more from a house and then have more to spend. But then if you got to move somewhere else, then it kind of doesn't really, in the long run, pan out because you end up paying more for another house.
And you're right. We'll see that logic a lot of the times where people will want to wait because, hey, my property's going up on my home. Well, hey, that's great. You made an extra $50,000 on the house. Yeah. But the houses went up by $50,000, so it's a wash. And so if you're looking to buy a house today, if you're looking to sell a house, I mean, really now truly is the time to do it. Interest rates are at an all-time low. The housing market is, the inventory is lacking. So you've got to really, if you're trying to sell, you know, you need, it's a hot time to be able to sell. But then also purchasing, like I said, there's not about to be a flood of new homes come on the market. And so prices are just going to keep going up higher and higher.
But it does seem like there's a lot of building going on all over town. So, I mean, you say that there's not going to be a whole lot of new homes, but it seems like they're cranking them out.
Yeah, they are. There's a ton of building going on all over town. However, if you were to look at the data, look at the people that are coming to Nashville and the people that are slated to come to Nashville over the, for the next 3 years, the number of people that are coming here far exceeds the number of new housing starts. And so while, yes, there isn't a ton of construction going on, it's nowhere close to filling the need of the people that are coming here for the next 3 years.
Now, do the people that are coming here from other states, does that generally tap into a certain price category of house?
Yes, it does. And so that's also what's driving up the prices. A lot of those people are coming here from either the East Coast or the West Coast. And typically they're selling their home and they're just bringing significant equity with them. And so that means that there's a lot of cash buyers that are out there. Those same people are going to be selling a home in the West Coast for, say, $1 million. So when they're coming here, they're buying a house for $600,000, $700,000, and they're paying cash. And so normally that's where that price point is going to be, somewhere between $400,000 and $700,000. But those are also a lot of cash buyers, which make it that much harder to compete.
Yeah. Not a whole lot of houses being built in the 250 and under category, at least not right in the middle of things, maybe further out.
You've got to go further out. And that's what we're starting to see a lot of younger people do, to go on kind of the outskirts out of the greater MSA area. just to get that price point of that $200,000 and $250,000 house. It doesn't exist in Nashville. And if it does exist, the home is in a state of disrepair and you've got a lot of work to do. But to find that house that you can move into for $200,000, you know, you've got to go a good 50, 60 minutes outside of Nashville.
That's true. Or be prepared to do a lot of work on it.
Absolutely.
A friend of mine would refer to those houses that they need a lot of TLC. Tons of labor and cash. That's what they need. Because, I mean, I've got a borrower right now who's buying a house that needs a lot of TLC. But luckily, he's the kind of guy who knows how to do that kind of thing. So it's going to be worth it for him. But that's what he needed to do to get into the neighborhood he wanted to be in at the price point that he wanted to be in. So, Steve, what kind of demographic are you seeing? The people that are coming to town, do they fit a particular profile?
Sort of. So there's lots of different groups that are coming, but one of the biggest population increases we've seen is actually in the younger demographics.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know, people who are fresh out of college or maybe they're in their late 20s, they're looking for a place to settle down. Nashville's kind of like that hip, cool, you know, southern city that people are really attracted to.
We are hip and cool. That's probably the only thing that makes me hip and cool is that I live here. Nothing else about me is hip and cool. So, you know,
probably
ask my kids.
I didn't want to tell you that.
Yeah.
But
thanks
a
lot.
You're probably right.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. So this is kind of the hot place to be. And so many companies are moving here also.
Yes. Yeah. Especially like take Amazon as an example. So Amazon's workforce is typically on the younger side, believe it
okay.
or not. So a lot of the jobs that are coming here are high paying jobs, but it's also younger demographics. So those people are going to be purchasing, you know, maybe their first home, because if they're coming from a place like Seattle where real estate prices are really high, they were probably renting. So
Joe was saying, just because people who come from California, typically in New York where the high home prices are really high, a lot of times if they sold those houses, they got tons of cash to spend here. But if they're coming from a place like Seattle, maybe not so much, because their housing prices are
really high.
Really high.
Yes.
And maybe they don't have as much equity.
Yes. So if they've been renting, they don't have any equity. So when they're coming here, they're looking at first time home buyer programs. They're looking at low down payment, you know, first time home buyer options. And so those people are just entering the market for the first time. So since they don't have that equity, they're looking a little bit on the lower end of the market.
Right.
You know, usually just so that they can get in and get their first house and really get familiar with Nashville and decide where it is they want to live.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of times you would think that it would be smarter to just rent for a while if you've never lived here before or anywhere. You move to a completely brand new place that you've never lived at before. It might be hard to pick a neighborhood unless you've got really good advice. But I've known people who've moved here from California and just bought a house because it showed well, or in one particular case, just bought it off the internet, you know. The first time he saw it was when he got here.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh.
Well, those people are a lot braver than I am. So like when I moved to Nashville, because I'm not from here.
Yeah.
So when I moved to Nashville, we rented an apartment. We had a 6-month lease. We were here for about 3 months and then decided on where we wanted to be for our first house.
And what kind of research did you do to kind of figure out what part of town you wanted to be in?
You know, a lot of it had to do with the school district.
Okay.
So when we moved here, you know, our intention was to settle down, have kids. So schools were very important to us.
Right.
You know, affordability, I think, was a big part of it.
Sure.
You know, every year rents go up. And so we didn't want to continue renting, even if we could be closer to downtown. So we actually bought our first house about 35 minutes outside of downtown.
Okay. Okay.
You know, kind of like Joe mentioned, that first-time homebuyer price range, you know, not necessarily just first-time homebuyers, but
right.
that lower side price range, you do have to go outside of town to get that.
But that kind of circles back to what we were talking about earlier about waiting. You know, is it a good idea to wait? You know, because you get here. Okay, so let's say you have a good idea where you want to be because you've got a good agent and they've steered you in the right direction, but sometimes people might think they might wait for that lower interest rate or something or a better house to come along. And that can be a problem because the savings you might get from a lower payment might be outweighed by what you forego in amortization or value, home value rising.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things to take into consideration there. So as home values go up, rent's going to keep going up too.
Rents are crazy right now.
Rents are crazy.
I see what people are paying and it's more than mortgage payments in many cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of that too is you never know when your rent's going to go up.
That's true.
With a mortgage payment, you know, if you're buying something that you can afford, you can expect that your payment's going to be about the same every month.
Right. Yeah, because your payment on a fixed rate mortgage, it's fixed.
Right.
So the only thing that might change is for most people, their property taxes and homeowners insurance are built into the loan payment.
Right.
That might go up.
Yeah, but
I mean, taxes usually go up. They don't typically go down. I have yet to see that happen.
Unfortunately,
we might get lucky. At some point, we get a letter in the mail that says, good news, we've cut your taxes in half. But I doubt that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And generally speaking, I've seen taxes, when they do increase, it may go up like 10 or 15 bucks a month.
Yeah.
So if your rent goes up 100 bucks, but your taxes only go up 10 or 15, I'd rather be in a mortgage payment all day.
That's right. That's right. And with homeowners insurance, you can shop that around. So, I mean, if it, you know, typically when you're a brand new customer with an insurance company, you might get a good rate. But then as the years creep on, it just goes up and up. And for most people, it's okay, it's time to go see what else is out there and bring it back down again. So you do have a little bit of control over your mortgage payment by doing that.
Yes.
But so, it takes a little bit of work.
Yeah. So if you're looking at renting versus buying, you know, don't play the interest rate game.
Yeah.
Because you want to be looking at, you know, can I find the right house in the neighborhood I want to be in and afford the payment? Because when interest rates do go down, that's when you have the opportunity to refinance.
Right.
So when you're purchasing a house, it's more about getting the right house. You know, once you own the house and you want to look at refinancing for whatever reason, then you can play a little bit more conservative. But, you know, rates, though they do change, they don't change a whole lot in a short period of time. So
that's true. That's something that I think a lot of people forget, is that it's not like they're going to go from 3 to 10 in a week. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, we've never seen that.
Right. They creep up ever so slightly as time goes on, you know. So really, the difference between, you know, a 3.5 and a 3.625 is so negligible.
Right.
That it's not worth all the other benefits that you're losing. One of the benefits that a lot of people don't talk about is that on a home, there's certain tax advantages. You get to write off your mortgage interest. You don't get to write off your rent.
Right. Yeah, that's a very important thing, actually, that I think a lot of people don't consider. And the limit, you know, this is going to apply to most of us out there. So the limit is actually $500,000. You can write off interest on a total debt of $500,000. So if you own a house that's got, you know, a mortgage on it less than $500,000, like most of us,
right,
then you get to write off that interest, whereas you don't get to write off your rent.
It would be nice.
It would be nice. Yeah.
It would be nice. But just another reason why it's a good idea to get into a home versus renting. And if you can do it, to get out there and do it now. So that about wraps it up for us this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Steve, thanks for being on the show with us again this week.
Thank you.
And thanks to Joe Stanford of Accurate Mortgage for coming and joining us earlier. If you've got anything that you'd like to know about and there's any questions you have, hit us up at hinoshomeshow.com. You can submit your questions there. We'd love to hear from you. And if you've got anything to say about the short-term rentals or anything like that, we'd love to hear about that too. So check us out at hinoshomeshow.com. We'll see you back next week.